Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session today, you can press star one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'll turn the call over to Mr. Glenn Novack. You may begin, sir.
Thank you, and thank you all for joining us this afternoon for our weekly update on H1N1 flu. Today, we have Dr. Daniel Jernigan, a medical epidemiologist who is the deputy director of our influenza division here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Jernigan will be providing an update on the H1N1 flu and seasonal flu in the United States as of today. We are also joined today by Dr. Jay Butler. Dr. Butler is a medical epidemiologist at CDC, and he is the chief of our 2009 H1N1 vaccine task force. Dr. Butler will be giving an update on where we stand with respect to the 2009 H1N1 vaccine and its availability and distribution. I will start by turning the mic over to Dr. Dan Jernigan to give an update on the current flu situation in the United States. Dr. Jernigan?
Thank you very much. Well, the flu season has begun. It's begun early, and nearly all of the influenza that we're seeing is this novel H1N1 virus. What we see are that children and young adults are still being hit the hardest, which is something we saw in the spring, and it's showing itself again in the fall and in the late summer here in the United States. We are finding that there is flu being reported in all 50 states. There are 21 states that are reporting widespread activity. We don't see that kind of activity this time of year usually. It's a very strange thing for us to see that amount of influenza at this time of year. We monitor the numbers of patients that go into certain emergency clinics and to outpatient clinics. And with that information, we can see if there's increases in the numbers of people coming in with flu. And what we find is that there is an increased amount of folks that are coming into the clinics with influenza. It's about twice at least what we would expect for this time of year. If you talk to doctors, they'll tell you, boy, I'm seeing lots of flu at this time of year. That's something that we do not see normally. But we don't only want to look at what's happening in the outpatient setting. We also want to look at what's happening in hospitalizations and in hospitals. And what we see so far is that there is some increase in the rate of hospitalizations for younger children and for adults, but it is not up at the same levels that we would see during seasonal flu. So it's something that we want to watch very closely. But at this time, we're seeing lots of activity in the outpatient setting and seeing some activity in hospitals. We look at all of the viruses that are turned into CDC from multiple different laboratories around the nation and around the world, and what we found is that the vast majority of the influenza viruses that are circulating are the novel H1N1. So far, we find that the virus that's circulating right now is a good match to the new vaccine that's being developed and being manufactured and distributed. We also find that the virus still maintains a high level of susceptibility to Tamiflu or also Tamivir, the antiviral drugs used to treat it. We're also encouraged that we don't find any changes in this virus that would suggest that there might be increased virulence, that is, increased severity of disease because of changes in the virus that might occur. I think we certainly do expect to see a whole lot more illness in the coming weeks and throughout the U.S. flu season. We expect that if the H1N1 remains the predominant strain, that more younger people will be affected than we might think or might see in the past. In the past, in flu seasons, older individuals are often more affected, but we may see that younger individuals are more affected this year, and so that's something we want to watch very carefully, and also another reason why it's important to get vaccinated when the vaccine becomes available. Unfortunately, because there will be lots of cases of moderate disease, we will have some hospitalizations. We will also have some deaths that will be due to the H1N1 and to influenza this year. That's something that we expect, but something that we want to prevent with vaccination. Flu activity will vary, so some parts of the country will have disease while some parts may not. We may see waves of disease going from one part of the country to another. In the southeast right now, there's a considerable amount of influenza disease, very consistent with the opening of schools earlier in the southeast. as schools opened after Labor Day, we may expect that increases in numbers of cases will occur in other parts of the country where kids are now getting back together. Most of the illness, like I said, appears to be moderate or moderately severe, and that's good news, but it's not always the case, and it could change, and that's why we want to monitor the virus and monitor disease very closely in case there's anything that suggests that this virus is changing. Prevention, of course, is the most important thing. We know that flu viruses can cause severe illness, and so the first thing that one can do right now is to get seasonal vaccine. The seasonal vaccine is out there. It's in doctors' offices, and so make an appointment to get the seasonal vaccine if you're indicated to get it. It's especially important for people that are over age 50, for children, pregnant women, and people with underlying conditions like heart and lung diseases. This year, we expect 115 million doses to be available. There have been apparently 54 million doses already distributed. And in many places, providers have seasonal flu vaccine. They have it now, but there will be more distributed, so folks will be able to find it. Of course, vaccination is the most important thing to do, but there are other things that you can do. That includes taking regular precautions like washing your hands, covering your cough, and staying home when you're sick. And also, if your doctor recommends, you should get antiviral drugs, then that's something that you should do. As a physician myself, I think it's always better to err on the side of being healthy than sick. And so taking those precautions like getting vaccinated, making sure you're using appropriate hand hygiene and cough etiquette, and taking antiviral drugs if your doctor recommends them are things that are very important, but also to take advantage of the safe and effective H1N1 vaccine when it becomes available. And with that, I'll hand this over to Dr. Butler.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jernigan, and good afternoon or good morning for those of you on the line. This afternoon, I'd like to provide an update on the status of the H1N1 vaccine program. A couple of events have developed over the past week, which I think are important. The FDA has licensed the H1N1 vaccine from four of the five manufacturers, and that's one of the important steps towards making the vaccines available. We also have data now that there's a good antibody response to the vaccine, that adults appear to have a robust antibody response that suggests that a single dose should provide protection. And additionally, there's been no mutation in the virus. So right now, there's every indication that we have a good match between the virus that's causing disease and the vaccines that we'll have to be able to prevent it. And that's critical to be able to anticipate that we'll have a very effective vaccine for prevention. The H1N1 vaccine is an influenza vaccine. It's pretty much identical to the seasonal flu vaccines. It's just directed against this new virus. Raises the question of, well, why isn't it in the seasonal flu vaccine this year? Simple reason is the virus didn't exist at the time that the seasonal flu vaccine was being formulated. So this has been able to be developed very rapidly, and we anticipate that it'll be available during October. We actually anticipate being able to start receiving orders for the vaccine by early October, and actually vaccine going out and being distributed by providers by the first week of October. The distribution process is fairly complex. The government has purchased 195 million doses. It's a very large logistical undertaking to get this vaccine from five manufacturers out to some 90,000 provider sites around the country. Initially, we anticipate that about 3.4 million doses of vaccine will be available. Additional vaccine may be available as well, but 3.4 is the hard number that we have right now. And all of that vaccine is the live attenuated vaccine, which is the nasal spray. Same type of vaccine as the nasal spray vaccine that's used for seasonal flu vaccine, but it's directed against the H1N1 virus. The centralized distribution system is one that is very similar to what's used currently for the Federal Vaccine for Children program. This distributes federally purchased vaccine out to about 40,000 sites nationally already. So this system has been enhanced, and there's been outreach at the state level to be able to enroll additional providers to be able to administer the vaccine. is a voluntary vaccination campaign. People have the opportunity to get vaccinated. Our goal is to ultimately make the vaccine available to every American who wishes to be vaccinated. The vaccine demand is hard to predict. And certainly as the rates of disease have gone up, we've become more and more concerned about making vaccine available as soon as possible to those who wish to receive it, to agencies that wish to be able to administer it. And there's a balance there, recognizing that there's demand, there's ability to administer it, and we also have disease. And finding that time to start the program is certainly a challenge. But we want to be able to make vaccine available as it's becoming available for shipment through the distribution process. As Dr. Jernigan mentioned, I don't want to take anything away from the importance of vaccination against seasonal influenza. Other strains of influenza probably will be circulating this winter as well. We've heard a lot of talk about what's going to happen, when peaks will occur. It's, I think Yogi Berra said it's very hard to make predictions, particularly about the future. There's much that we don't know about the epidemiology of the disease. We are getting a better handle on the availability of the vaccine, and we anticipate that the amount of vaccine that's available will continue to increase as the season moves on during October and through November, and that ultimately anyone who wishes to be vaccinated would have the vaccine available to them. And with that, I think I'll stop, and I'll be happy to take your questions, as will Dr. Jernigan.
Thank you. We will start with a question from the room. Mike Stobie.
Thanks. Mike Stobie from the AP. Dr. Butler, just to go over what you just said, 3.4 million doses, were you referring to early October, and how many providers are going to get that? I'm trying to figure out the logistics.
And again, 3.4 is sort of the hard bottom number. We may have additional doses of injectable vaccine available by then, but that information is still forthcoming from the manufacturers. The number of providers will be determined by the orders that come out of the state. The system has been set up to be able to provide maximum flexibility to address the fact that healthcare delivery and healthcare systems and even public health is different in different regions of the country. And there's differences state to state, that one size doesn't fit all. So this allows the states to be able to dictate how much vaccine comes into their jurisdictions at what time and to whom.
What's your best guess? How many providers will be getting those 3.4 million doses?
Well, there's 90,000 distribution sites, ultimately. How many of those are providers versus then situations such as a retail chain that will then redistribute it among their outlets? I don't have a good handle for that yet. So I think it's important to recognize that the 90,000 is not always a provider's office, but it may be a point where the vaccine will then be distributed even further within a jurisdiction or within a company.
Thank you. Operator, we will take a question from the phone.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question on the phone lines, press star 1. Our first question comes from Marion Falco with CNN Medical News. You may ask your question.
Thank you for taking the questions. I have two. Number one, are you encouraging folks who aren't in the high-risk groups to wait? Obviously, with the first wave being the live attenuated virus, it eliminates people who are younger than 2 and older than 49 and pregnant women. But are you encouraging folks to wait if they aren't in those high-risk groups? And secondly, I know the vaccine was approved at 15 micrograms. One shot is what was needed. Is that going to be what everyone's going to get, pregnant women and children? Could you clarify how many shots people will get?
Sure. I will have Dr. Butler answer this question.
Yes. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices provided recommendations on who should receive the vaccine first based on the epidemiology of disease, who's at highest risk. And I think probably everybody's aware of those groups in general. It's younger people, adults with underlying illnesses, and people who are at risk of transmitting the illness, such as healthcare workers or people who live with or care for infants younger than 6 months of age, an age at which vaccination is not possible. The recommendations are out there, and I think an important factor to keep in mind is there's no magic to this. This is a huge logistical process. And there's not sudden appearance of vaccine in 90,000 refrigerators around the country. So in general, the recommendations are that the people who are in the highest risk groups are the ones who should be vaccinated first. But in any given location, the availability of vaccine may actually vary. So oftentimes that decision of who is actually administered the vaccine may be ultimately decided by the provider and the patient. The recommendations are out there, though, that the highest priority groups are those impacted by disease, and those are the groups outlined by the ACIP. The question about number of doses, the package inserts are reading that a single dose would be required for people age 10 and older. We anticipate that two doses will be required for younger children, and this is pretty much the same case as occurs with seasonal flu vaccine.
And we'll take a question from the room.
Hello. Thank you for making time. My name is Kip Grossing for Fox News Channel. I've got a question for Dr. Jernigan, please. Curious if you're aware of the work of Dr. Lipsitch in Harvard, and if you could comment on that.
Yeah, the work from Dr. Lipsitch is work based on some collaborations that we had with him over the spring and in the summer. That work is looking at how severe is the pandemic and what are some estimates. And so we were able to provide some of the information to that, but the estimates in that are the work of Dr. Lipsitch and not necessarily from the federal government. But they do indicate that the amount of disease is about what we would expect for a severe influenza season and not at the levels of the pandemics from 1918 or 1957.
Well, on the face of it, that would sound like good news. Would you agree with that?
I think it is good news. And so in that it corroborates what we've been seeing with all of the surveillance, what we have been seeing from the anecdotes from doctors and from the reports of cases. The concerning things, of course, are that there appear to be some differences with this virus in how it infects the lungs. That's something we want to watch very closely. It may be that there is a small subset of patients that when they do get sick go on to have very severe disease. It doesn't minimize the fact that influenza kills and causes disease in a lot of people every year. And so even a moderate influenza season has a lot of morbidity and mortality. And so we don't want to lose that in this. It's encouraging, but we know that influenza viruses can change very quickly. They've done that in the past by switching to become completely resistant or completely changing the subtype. And so we have to monitor this quickly so that we don't have something that appears to be what happened many years ago when there was fairly moderate disease and then a change in the character of the influenza. So we want to be prepared, but we are encouraged.
Does this change the way you behave moving forward?
We have been moving forward by using the information that we get, letting the science direct us, letting the surveillance information tell us about the virus, looking at patients, and then letting that determine how we act, but at all times being prepared in case something changes.
Operator, we will take another question from the phone.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Stephen Smith with Boston Globe. You may ask your question.
Hi, good afternoon, and thanks for taking the call. In the wake of the PCAST report that came out last month, which, as you know, for modeling purposes, said that H1N1 this fall could result in 30,000 to 90,000 deaths, there continues to be confusion about what to expect from the virus. And while PCAST insists those figures were not meant to be estimates, the reality is that in many quarters they have been interpreted as such. So at CDC, are there actual working estimates of how many deaths from H1N1 might result this fall? And have those changed over time with a better understanding of the virus? And how should the public and public health officials, for that matter, square these planning scenario figures with the CDC's own data showing that so far there have been fewer than 1,000 H1N1 deaths?
Sure. I'll have Dr. Jernigan answer the question.
Yes, I think you point out the difference between planning scenarios and monitoring what's going on. And so we have ways of estimating the numbers of deaths, the numbers of hospitalizations. looking to see with what we're seeing with the actual numbers coming in, how do they compare to what we might expect. Some of that information, I think, is very close to coming out that we would be able to provide to you, similar to how Dr. Lipsitch's information came out as well. We are likely to have numbers that look very similar to what Dr. Lipsitch had, but the virus, I think we have to continue to monitor. There's only so much that you can do with forecasting. It helps us to understand what resources might be needed, what policies might need to be changed, but we don't want to provide a very specific number because all of those numbers are estimates. They're based on many assumptions, and so we want that information that comes out to be as realistic as possible. Through the summer, we have been collecting a lot of information, have been working with a lot of collaborators, and I think that that's really helped us refine the numbers so that they will be as accurate as possible.
Thank you. Operator, I'll take another question from the phone.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Maggie Fox with Reuters. You may ask your question.
Hi, thanks very much. I want to ask you about how fast the virus is moving and how many people you think can get vaccinated ahead of some of the waves of the pandemic. Is there any way of people kind of calculating when they're going to get vaccine and whether it's going to be in time? Thanks.
Sure. I will have Dr. Butler address that question.
Well, that's a great question because it's one of the ones that we always ask as well. In terms of movement of the virus, I suppose we could say it's gone viral. We're continuing to see increasing rates of disease around the country, and it's one of the reasons why we're concerned about making the vaccine available as soon as possible. There are certainly technical and logistical limitations, but we want to make that available as broadly as possible, as much vaccine as possible, as quickly as we can. In terms of predicting just what that will be, there's a lot of moving parts, and that's why I really want to talk now. We're close enough that I think we need to talk in terms of really firm numbers, vaccine that has gone through the clearance lot release process and that we are beginning to look at actual delivery dates to the distributor. We will know more really day by day. It's a very dynamic process. I would love to be able to give you harder numbers and a more definite answer because that would be very helpful for us for the planning purposes. And we will know much more a week from now than we know today.
Operator, I'll take another question from the phone.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Richard Knox with National Public Radio. You may ask your question.
Hi, thanks for the chance. I want to be clear about whether there's any thought of prioritization or guidance for who should get the very first doses. When after Kathleen Sebelius said that there would be some beginning in the first week of October, some CDC people indicated to me that they might need to go to healthcare workers and first responders. But it sounds today as though you're saying, no, you're not prioritizing at all, and it's just whoever within the ACIP recommendations that's eligible for the nasal spray version should get it without any prioritization. Is that right?
Yeah, I will let Dr. Butler clarify that because I think he can correct that.
Yeah, there's not a recommendation of sub-prioritization beyond the level of what's in the ACIP statement, primarily for two reasons. One is there may be state-to-state differences, and I think the focus initially, if vaccine supplies are relatively limited on healthcare providers, makes a lot of sense. But in some states, getting vaccine to healthcare providers, if there's not large hospitals that it would be sent to, may be a little more of a challenge. So we want to be able to provide that flexibility for the local needs to be able to be met.
Thank you. Operator, I'll take another question.
Thank
you.
That's from David Brown with Washington Post. You may ask your question.
Thanks very much. Can you provide some detail about the logistics of this delivery system and how, if a clinic or a doctor or a hospital wants to be one of the 90,000 that gets it, how it gets on the list there? you know, where the McKesson site is, what the predicted turnaround time from the, you know, if a batch of vaccine arrives on Monday, how long does it take to say, okay, we're now going to divide these 10 million doses among 90,000 different, you know, receivers who all demand different amounts? You know, just give us some granular sense of how that's going to work and the amount of time it's going to take to process, you know, one batch of, one delivery of vaccine.
Sure, I will let Dr. Butler speak to that question.
Right. The ordering process, beginning from the provider, will be a request for vaccine that will go to the state health department. The state health department immunization coordinator each day will know the allocation of vaccine available to that state. And at the state and local level, the requests will be basically triaged to be able to direct where the vaccine goes. And then those orders will be transmitted daily to CDC, where they'll be collated. First thing, a day's orders will be transmitted to the distributor roughly 5 a.m. the next morning, and then those orders will start being filled, and will be filled within 3 business days. When the order is filled, it will be shipped by overnight express from the distributor to the provider. And those shipments will not occur on Friday or Saturday, of course, because we don't want vaccines showing up at locked doors or not being controlled or available. There are 4 distribution sites that vaccine will go out from, and that will help minimize the amount of transit time required. And I think you asked where those are, and I actually don't know the answer to that question, but they're geographically distributed to be able to provide vaccine to all states and territories as rapidly as possible.
First week of October, 50 states. If you do the math, that's 68,000 doses per state. Is that what's going to happen? 68,000 doses go to each state, and then they distribute?
Yeah, and keep in mind that 3.4 is the doses that we know will be basically on the pad when we open it. There will very likely be additional doses, but we don't know exactly how much will be available yet. The flow of vaccine the first week or two may be slower than what we would like. And, you know, it's the balance here is finding the sweet spot. Do we just hold vaccine in a warehouse until there's lots and we can send it out all at once? Or do we start the process earlier? And so we're trying to find the right balance of when we think there'll be enough vaccine so that there's not spot shortages, so that, just that math that you've done is exactly what we've been doing too, so that those numbers aren't too small.
And just to clarify the earlier comment, it'll be up to each state whether they give it only to healthcare workers or certain people that first week?
Right, and much of that really is most applicable during that first week when the amount of vaccine may be smaller. Again, we will know much more as we actually approach the date to begin receiving those orders of exactly how much will be available.
And maybe it would be helpful to clarify, are we talking an equal amount going to states, or are we talking about a pro rata,
right,
using population as a basis?
Yeah, the state allocations are based on population, so it's straight pro rata.
Operator, I'll take another question from the phone.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Bridget DeSimone with the NewsHour. You may ask your question.
Yes, thank you. It's Bridget DeSimone with the NewsHour, and I'm just wondering, do you anticipate that some healthcare workers are going to resist getting the vaccine, and how do you deal with that?
I will have Dr. Butler address that question.
It's certainly possible that some healthcare workers may choose not to receive the vaccine. We know that happens with seasonal flu vaccine also. As a healthcare worker, actually, I've received the seasonal flu vaccine for more years than I think I can count now, at least 20 in a row now. I think it's, you know, personally, I feel like it's an important part of quality of care, that it's an opportunity not only to increase your chances of being able to come to work, but to decrease your chances of transmitting an infectious agent to at-risk patients. Certainly, there will be healthcare providers who will decline the vaccine, and I don't know what proportion that will be.
Okay.
Next question from the phone operator.
Our next question comes from Janelle Alicia with MSNBC.com. You may ask your question.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for taking the call. You know, we've had so many people come down, of course, with H1N1 already, and the question that I seem to be hearing over and over again is they're wondering if they're protected against the virus and if they should still go ahead and get the vaccine when it becomes available. What advice are you giving them?
Sure. Well, Dr. Butler, answer that question as well.
People who have actually been infected with the 2009 H1N1 virus likely do have some immunity, but the important issue is whether or not they know that's what they were actually infected with. And the vast majority of cases occur without laboratory confirmation. It's also important to realize that many cases of influenza-like illness may not be caused by the 2009 H1N1. Early in the epidemic, we had other strains of influenza circulating. There are other viruses that can make people ill as well. So even if someone has had an illness that was similar to influenza, even if there was perhaps a clinical diagnosis of H1N1 infection made, our recommendation would still be to receive the vaccine so that you know that you're immune. There's no evidence that even if you have immunity, getting a vaccine would cause problems or increase the chances of a reaction. So that would be our recommendation. Certainly for myself, if I had been ill in the past 6 months without a lab confirmation, I would definitely want to get the vaccine.
Thank you. Operator, we have time for one more question from the phone.
Thank you, and that's from Betsy McKay with Wall Street Journal. You may ask your question.
Hi. Thanks very much. Dr. Butler, a couple more questions about distribution. One is, if we're talking about getting vaccine now in early October, can you tell us what deliveries will be like going forward from there? I mean, are we still talking about 45 million doses by mid-October and 20 million every week after that until 195 million at the end of the year, or has that schedule changed? And the other question I wanted to ask is if you can tell us what you and or the states are doing to ensure that the recommended groups get vaccine first, like are you able to steer, or are you planning to steer vaccine to certain providers like OBGYNs and pediatricians rather than, you know, larger clinics or pharmacies?
Okay. Thank you for those questions. It actually raises a very important point about how to perceive the vaccine distribution program. It is indeed a flow, and perhaps the image of a river helps with it. You have these five sources coming into a single flow of vaccine. Ultimately, you have maybe a braided delta with lots of points where ultimately the vaccine is going. That flow is anticipated to increase as more of the production capacity comes online, more manufacturers are contributing vaccine to the system. The exact numbers are very hard to nail down, as we've learned, but we would anticipate that once we're up and going, we should be seeing at least 20 million new doses of vaccine weekly going right on into December when we would hope to reach the capacity of having delivered 195 million doses. The question about recommended groups is a good example of why the state flexibility is very important. Some of the states have identified, for instance, maternity hospitals as where they might want a first direct vaccine, although if only live attenuated vaccine is available up front, that they wouldn't be able to use that for pregnant women, but if an injectable vaccine is available, they certainly could. They would also be able to vaccinate people who are very soon going to be living with or caring for an infant younger than 6 months, and they could target healthcare workers also. Not every state would have an institution that stands out as one that fits that description. So it's a decision that really does need to be made locally.
Well, thank you all for your participation this afternoon. We will have the transcripts posted as soon as we can, hopefully within a few hours. And I thank you for participating in today's press briefing. We are concluded. Thank you.
Thank you, and this does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. At this time, you may disconnect your lines.